Well, it's the middle of January, which means I guess we have to talk gardening. And I'm doing that with a friend of mine that I've known now, it turns out, for about 11 years. Her name is Kate Copsey. She's a garden writer. Where are you living right now, Kate?
We're in the Grand Garden State of New Jersey.
That's right. New Jersey is the Garden State. I don't think a lot of people know that, except for the people in New Jersey, who I'm sure know all about it.
Yes, and it's what I call the perfect state gardening-wise where we are, because it's far enough south that I can grow camellias, maybe,
Really? Oh,
crepe
maybe, okay.
myrtles, and all those good old southern plants. But it's also far enough north that we get enough coldness for things like rhubarb and lilacs. I mean, what more perfect place can you be?
You're talking New Jersey here, Kate. But never mind. I won't go down that road. Kate is the host of the Master Gardener Hour on americaswebradio.com. She's got a journal, a blog that she does about gardening, and you've also got one called The Renegade Celiac, which is on blogspot.com. Okay, I got to start there. What is that all about, Kate?
Oh, the renegade celiac one?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess I was diagnosed as being celiac and gluten-free back in the 60s. So I've been doing this since probably since before it caught on, and everybody kind of has been they've changed it a lot over the years. But yes, let's say I don't freak out about going and eating outside and all this cross-contamination stuff. I'm not I don't panic about eating out, and I've been known to have chicken nuggets from McDonald's and just pick the chicken out from the middle. That was before everybody was offering gluten-free options, and sometimes you've just got to do that if you're going to eat. So and I also drink European lagers, so
There you
I'm
go.
yeah so
But
a lot of
I didn't realize that celiac disease had been discovered that early, back in the 60s.
Oh, it was discovered, or it started to be from the Second World War, I think it was. And they realized that the Germans were taking all the good wheat from, I guess, Holland and places and France and places like that. And from what I can gather, it was just the dregs of grains that were given to the citizens that they were allowed to keep, and they found that these kids thrived on it. And when they reintroduced whole wheat again, they went downhill. So they some bright spark connected the wheat and the rye with this disease. And so by the time the 60s came round, it was still rare, but that was kind of I just happened to, I guess, luck out that I had the right physician at the right time.
Yeah, a lot of that sort of thing is if the person diagnoses you properly, because we've all heard horror stories about people who have one malady or another, and the problem is they don't get diagnosed properly. And then they try this and that and this medication and that treatment, and none of it works. And then suddenly somebody wakes up and says, "Well, what I think you've got is X or Y." And then suddenly they're fine. And, that's part of the problem with medical diagnosis. It's an inexact science sometimes.
Oh yes, and there are such various traits and symptoms of this that I guess the full-blown celiac back in the 60s, they could catch it. They were starting to catch it in babies, actually. As soon as they started to get on cereal, they were starting to a lot of the group and the crying and indigestion. They were starting to realize it then, but I don't think even then that they realized that there was this, shall we say, a line of slight intolerance to all the way down to full celiac disease. And that is a fairly new thing. And now, of course, you've got all these people on the health gig of gluten-free. So it's, and to some extent, I think that's helped the market, because now you can get halfway decent gluten-free bread and flours and things like that. But on the other hand, you know, when all these folks disappear and get back to a normal diet, you know, the South Beach diet or whatever they do next, I'm wondering how that's going to affect the true gluten-free market. But we'll see. I mean, I'm happy right now playing with actually making pastries and cakes and things like that, which is something that wasn't available very easily.
Right.
15 years ago.
Yeah, I know for a fact, because I know a friend of mine has celiac disease, and I've known about it for about 15 years. And they just had the hardest time finding anything. His wife, in those days, and this is in the late 90s, was searching and searching for gluten-free products, and invented a bunch of recipes. So she was always experimenting on him and bringing in. It was at a radio station I worked at, and she would bring in gluten-free products. And we would try them out, and she was a very good cook, and they were usually quite good. They were just as good as anything else that you might have with gluten in it, and we were always quite surprised by that. But you're right, it was really hard to get that stuff then.
Yeah, and to be honest, there really isn't a good bread. There was one over in England when I was last over there that's come out. It's called Genius, and they tried to bring it over here, but it's not here yet. But that was literally the best bread, and a really good substitute for regular soft white bread. They brought it over here and they tried to market it, but from what I can gather, they used a Canadian manufacturer and they tinkered with the recipe to make it more appealing to Americans, and it didn't catch on. So we have hope that they will be coming back, but it's probably going to take another couple of months before they even try the market again. They have to figure out how to get it into the market and sell it without it being contaminated.
Well, so you're talking about mass marketing here.
Yes.
And by the way, for the folks who just tuned in, we're talking to Kate Copsey, who is a garden writer and radio show host as well. And in Chicago, well, not just in Chicago, but in other parts of the country, there are specialty stores. I know of one in Chicago called Colatex Bakery, and they're on the northwest side here at Harlem and Grand in Chicago. And they have 44 different kinds of bread, including gluten-free breads and spelt breads. You can get anything you want, and they're excellent.
Oh, wow.
But not everybody has that in their neighborhood, and so sometimes it can be hard to find that stuff.
Yes. And if I could import it from Europe, who have been a few years ahead and advanced from the American market, I would do, but I'm not quite sure how to do that.
Well, and then that takes us back to our origins together, how we know each other. Now, obviously, the folks listening to this know that you're probably not from America originally. What's your background in history?
Well, I love garden history, over in England, I guess I grew up not really gardening until we hit a house that had got about 6 different mints in it. And I always thought of mint as being mint is mint is mint. And this house had got peppermint and spearmint and apple mint.
And were they, those were planted in the yard?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I have.
And it's amazing how well behaved it was.
Really? Because, you know, the rule of thumb on mint is friends don't let friends plant mint. Okay. It can take over everything, and I'm surprised that they were well behaved. Why do you think that was?
To be honest, I don't know. It could have just been I was a novice and didn't know it. Maybe they don't flower as much over there because the season isn't so long. I don't know, but these things maybe they were just cut down and used so much that they never got to the flowering stage,
huh.
And they were just weeded out the runners and things.
Right, because, that's the problem, is the runners. It's not really so much the flowers, it's the runners. They'll take off and they'll take over everything.
Yes. And I think you have to weed them out really quickly. But no, I don't remember it going rampant, which is strange. I mean, my mother had the most polite mint patch you could ever imagine, and she mowed it down twice a year, and it never went anywhere.
That's you're the only one on the planet. You realize that, of course, don't you? You're the only one.
I always keep mint in a pot.
A good idea. All right, now, when did you come to the States? When I met you, you were living in Indianapolis or near Indianapolis. When did you come over to the States?
In the early 80s, just after Princess Diana and Charles got married. So they got married and we left about 6 months later. We started out in Buffalo, New York, but we then moved to the Indianapolis area. And I certified, I guess, as a master gardener in Virginia. And I think maybe I was already a master gardener when I got to Indianapolis. And I think we met because I was in charge of doing some advanced education, and what better person than the host of a major garden show in Chicago? I figured we'll get you down to come and talk to the master gardeners. And from what I can gather from talking to you since, it kind of freaked you out a bit talking to a real audience.
Exactly. I had been doing radio for several years, and had not done that was my very first garden talk. All right, being thrown into this room with a bunch of master gardeners from Indiana, and I had about half as much material as I needed. Nowadays, you can't shut me up, but at the time, I realized I was running out of material at the end, and I was just kind of in a flop sweat the whole thing, and I just thought, oh my gosh, Kate's never going to speak to me again. But it was, you have to start somewhere. It was just a kind of a baptism of fire, because you always figure that, well, master gardeners know their stuff. And if you're a fraud, they will smell it a mile away. I was very glad to have done that and survived it. And since then, I've done hundreds of talks. I think I've done about 250 since that first, I did one last night in Indiana, of all places, but up along Lake Michigan in Miller Park, and a great group of people. But the question I have for you, you mentioned, okay, where are the different places you've lived? You came to Buffalo, Indianapolis, you mentioned Virginia, you were in Atlanta for a while, weren't you?
Yes, we were.
You're in New Jersey. How many different zones have you been in?
Atlanta was certainly the warmest. That was a 7B, probably reclassified as an 8 by now. And the northernmost one was probably Albany, New York, which I think is probably almost a 5. But that one was the further north that we've been. Buffalo, of course, has a lot of snow. And they used to say, actually, all along the lake, whether you're in Cleveland or Buffalo or Erie, Pennsylvania, that if the lake didn't freeze, you were a zone 6, because you got that warm lake water coming over. And this just applies to maybe 4 or 5 miles inside the lake shore. But if the lake froze, then those vortexes would come down and bring the cold from over the lake. And
yes,
you were a zone 5, huh, if that.
How about that?
And of course, it all depended very much on how much snow you have, because snow is a great insulator.
Well, yes, and in, you must have looked with interest at the beginning of this winter, when in a course of about 2 days, Buffalo got about 7 feet of snow. That must have brought back fond memories.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, thank goodness we don't live there any longer.
but I guess the question I would have for you, Kate, is most gardeners don't move as often as you do. What have you learned? Because I'm sure not only have you been in different zones, but you've probably gone from alkaline to acidic, clay to good draining soil. I mean, all kinds of different conditions that you've had to adapt to. What in general have you learned about moving to a new place and starting over with your garden?
To some extent, I think when we were moving from, I believe it was Avon Lake in Ohio, and we were moving from there to, I think, Virginia, and somebody said, because I wanted to take some of the plants with me, and somebody said, you need to call the extension office. And this was before, I don't think they had a master gardener thing at the time. And the guy said, well, this is how you take a cutting. And I said, well, I've got about 50 plants to do. He said, by the time you get to the end of that, you'll probably know how to get a cutting done. And, you know, and so I've been taking plants with me. Because we tend to go with commercial transport, I do get them certified as being clean, just
good
like
for you.
Any nursery would have to.
Yes.
Get them phyto-certified. And there are some things that are worth taking and some things that aren't. But the worst conditions I think we had were maybe in Virginia, where we were on a very rocky soil, and you can do an awful lot. But if you're basically in the foothills of a mountain range that are built up from rock, there's really no other way than having to do raised beds. So we had some gardens at the bottom where there weren't so many rocks, but where you've got rocks, I mean, you either leave them and expose them and just have them as part of the landscape, or you find somewhere else in there to grow. And now we're on sand. And in fact, Albany, New York was sand as well. And that's a very different thing to grow on. Midwest has got clay. Atlanta
right.
had good red clay. You can make bricks out of it. But the sand is very different. And again, I'm using raised beds because that's a really good way of growing vegetables anyway. The rest of the garden, the flower garden, just compost and bulk compost over everything to about 6 inches deep, and then I plant in that, and it seems to work okay.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because as I said, I spoke last night in Indiana along Lake Michigan, and the folks there at the Miller Garden Club also have sand, and their problems are very different from what we've got in Chicago, where we have, as you mentioned, clay and alkaline soil, and they have sand and slightly acidic soil. Very different. Now, this is in a small area here, but of course in Michigan they have more acidic conditions as well. And did you find that some of the times you moved that you might take a plant with you and it just utterly failed because it had the wrong conditions for survival?
I'm not sure that I've really kept track of which ones survive. Usually when they're in transit, they're dormant. And some things just don't come out of dormancy. I don't think I've had anything that I can attribute directly to acidic soil or alkaline soil, mainly because most of the places, I think, by the time you put compost in, you're naturally making it acidic, which probably took care of most of the alkaline. And I think if it was a particular area where it was slightly more acidic, you put lime on it. But most of the plants I've found, generally, it takes them a year before they start failing. And they don't croak automatically, but it's more actually from the moisture level. I killed more than enough down in Atlanta by thinking that they were drooping because they were dehydrated. And in fact, if you look at a lot of plants when it's very hot, their leaves curl down. And that doesn't mean that they're gasping for water, which I thought they were. It basically means that all these stomata underneath the leaves contract to stop evaporation. And then in the evening, everything comes out normal. But I wasn't smart enough to know that, and I killed more than enough plants by overwatering, which I know not to do any longer.
Well, you know, I think that's how most people kill their plants, not just outdoors, but especially indoors. They overwater. They think, and part of the problem is they water on their schedule, not the plant's schedule. You need to pay attention to your plant, and first of all, you got to know what its needs are. So, for instance, if you've got a peace lily, you know that it loves water, and it's going to be hard to kill it by drowning it. But there are a lot of other plants that you better be careful and let them dry out first before you add more water, or you're going to do them in. And as you've pointed out, that can happen outdoors too. Folks, we're talking to Kate Copsey, who's a garden writer and a master gardener. And what state are you at? You're in New Jersey. Do you have you gotten the New Jersey Master Gardener certificate yet?
Oh yes, yes, it transferred quite happily.
Oh, they transfer. I didn't know they transfer them.
Yes, I'm active in one of the community gardens that we have, and I do a lot of talks in this area, and which is great fun. But I've also talked in Pennsylvania and places like that as well. I did a couple last year in Pennsylvania, not as a master gardener. I do that as a private citizen, but because I get paid for that. But
right.
Yes, I do a lot for the master gardeners in this particular state, and it's great fun. I of communicating to people and helping them.
When I met you, you had a fascination with herbs, or as you guys call them, herbs. Do you still grow a lot of herbs?
Oh, absolutely, particularly the culinary ones. But you know, they are true survivors, and so I've always got a lot of herbs in the garden. The deer don't worry them, and we have a friendly little herd here. The groundhog I don't think worries them too much, although he did a number on my chives this year. You know, wildlife. But yes, I still grow quite a lot of herbs, and in fact, it was because of the herbs that I got into a lot of historic topics, because I was asked to do a talk on knot gardens.
And I'm sorry, could you say that again? I think you broke up a little bit here on the Skype.
Oh, yes, I was asked to do a talk on knot gardens. And if you mention a knot garden to a non-gardener, they haven't a clue what you're talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, and a lot of gardeners actually have heard of them, but just don't know what they are.
And how do you spell spell that?
K-N-O-T.
Oh, not, okay, not garden, yeah. Just like it sounds, all right.
That's right, and they are the intricate medieval to Elizabethan type gardens before the parterres came in, which were the big floral design thingies. But they basically are a green outline, whether it be boxwood or maybe a small holly or something like that, that runs around in different areas, and the parts appear to weave up and over each other, and they're very difficult to actually maintain because everything has to be all the same size. If you're in Cleveland, Ohio, the garden there, the botanic garden there, has a very large knot garden. There's also one in DC in the National Arboretum over there. But they are really, because if you've got a hedge that's maybe 5 foot in each direction or a square, and you've got, say, boxwood around there, every now and then on average winter, one of those boxwoods is going to die, which gives you a gap. So you have to have some spares at the right size and the right maturity to be able to plonk in there. They're tricky to maintain. They generally don't have flowers on the inside. So this is basically different contrasting greens and grays, but evergreen material. Mm. And so they look just as nice in winter as they do in summer. And they transitioned into the more gaudy, rather large landscapes that covered an acre or so in France and England, that royal houses did them, before the flowers all came in and they did the carpet type stuff.
Well, you know, so that... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so they're great fun to look at, and that's kind of how I got into historic gardening, which is a great. I'm a great fan of garden history and how these things came about. It was good fun.
I'm a fan of last year's history. That's as far as I go back, generally. I'm kidding, but last year was a brutal winter in the northern climes of the United States, especially Midwest through the East. A lot of boxwoods kicked the bucket last year. A lot of evergreens of different, I mean, plants that normally make it through just fine were burnt. By the winter last year, a lot of people were replacing those boxwoods last year.
Yeah.
Did you have the same problem in New Jersey?
I don't think, excuse me, I don't recall a lot of deaths from boxwood per se. It happened in Atlanta on one of the very long cool winters, because we have to call Atlanta a cool winter, even though they think it was cold.
Yes.
But the
Yeah.
amount of moisture coming down was significant enough that a lot of the rosemaries and things died that were mature rosemaries, not because of the cold, but more because of the lack of drainage all of a sudden that you get. Now, when you've got a very cold winter, and we had a couple of vortexes that wandered down. I mean, our winter over here, it just went on forever.
Yes.
I think they were saying a couple of weeks back that we had had this year something like 1.2 inches of snow. This time last year, we had almost 17 inches of snow.
Yeah, we've had
That's the difference between the two.
very similar here in the Midwest, especially in Chicago. Well, before I let you go, Kate, I want to ask you, let's take it back around to the beginning, and we were talking about celiac disease. Has your knowledge of having that affected your gardening in any way?
Well, apart from growing a lot of herbs and things, which kind of, I'm not a very good cook, and I'm very distracted. So I'll go out and maybe pick a few herbs, and then get distracted by looking at maybe the butterfly over on something else,
Yes.
whatever it was burning. But herbs actually, when you throw them in, they can give that extra bit of flavor, and so you don't need to go for the barbecue sauces and all those artificial flavors. But even just on a salad, all those salad dressings tend to have flour and whatever in them. But just a basic oil and vinegar, when you stuff a lot of herbs, maybe some fresh garlic in there with some chives and some parsley, maybe some oregano and thyme, and just make a mixed herb one. It is just as tasty on a salad as any of those other pourable things that come out of a bottle. And because they're freshly made, I happen to think that they're a little healthier for you.
I'm sure they are. How is it? How's your new radio job? You kind of had a you were doing a different show recently, and you got bumped up to the Master Gardener Hour. How's that working out for you?
Well, I'm having great fun with it. The previous show was America's Homegrown Veggies, which I
Oh,
did
that's
for
right, the
over.
veggie show, right. Yes, okay.
That's right. And I had that for 5 years, every week, and we talked about different aspects of growing veggies. Well, you can imagine after 250 weeks, that was starting to wear a little thin as to how different, what angle could I take
Yeah.
to make it different. And I felt I was getting a little stale, so I offered that out to somebody else, and Darryl Poulis is now doing that and having great fun. And the Master Gardener Hour, which was the first one I did on that station, was floundering a bit. They couldn't find hosts down in Atlanta to do the studio, and I said, well, I'll take that. And it's been great.
Well, Kate, congratulations on your success. Congratulations on your gardening. I'm sure you're going to move to Hawaii in another month or someplace else, and you'll be able to explain what Zone 10 is like and go on and on and on. Kate Copsey, the host of the Master Gardener Hour on www.americaswebradio.com. You can also find her at katesgardenjournal.com. You're going to have to bring it up to date now that I've mentioned it. So get writing on something.
Oh, yes. There are only so many hours in the day, Mike.
I do understand that. It was great talking to you again, Kate. And let me know if you want me to do a talk in New Jersey. I'm there.